the KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. for the Underground hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective. Our theme this month is apocalypse.
We'll have stories about personal apocalypse, tragic environmental accidents, radio plays, and other interpretations of the apocalypse.
Again, that's the Underground, Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. here on our community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Thank you so much for supporting KBOO during our recent spring membership drive.
Thank you.
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 We're really appreciative for all that you do to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Thanks.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. Coming right up, Old Mole Variety Hour. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local, independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 22nd Monday. Tammy Dean is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Joanna Misnick about Chicago and the DSA's success in their recent alderperson election, winning 6 seats in the 50-person city council. Joanna Misnick is a lifelong anti-war and union militant and is member of the SEIU Local 73 in Chicago, where she served as communications director. She's now active in Solidarity and the DSA. Clayton Morgridge discusses music, language, and capitalism. And in the second half of our show, Jan Hawken talks with Anais Tipker, who is with 350 PDX. They'll discuss an Earth Day event at the First Unitarian Church in Portland tonight, where 350 PDX will present a screening of the work-in-progress documentary Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance. This is directed by our own Jan Hawken and Samantha Prowse. The event includes a panel discussion with filmmakers and local activists and a reception to follow. More details on that to come later in the show. And from the Old Mole Archive, the importance of historical memory for social movements. Todd Sloan interviews Sandy Polshuk, who is an oral historian and longtime activist, on the importance of historical memory in social movements, both for inspiration and for the lessons that can be learned. This was originally recorded in October 12, 2015, and fits right in with Earth Day. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Joanna Misnick. Thank you.
Joanna Misnick, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Joanna Misnick grew up in Cleveland, lived in Detroit, and then Chicago for many, many years. She was a real active member of Local 73, SEIU. She, in fact, became communications director. You'll see why. She communicates really well. Through the entire period of her work in Chicago, she remained a left activist and the steering committees of various new and older left organizations. She dedicated to a democratic reconstruction from below that based on local union power from militant democratic unions and worker power and organizations that could accept some compromises as they gained power. Recently, she was amazed, as were many of us, by the rise of Bernie Sanders to nearly become the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. He failed in that, of course, but he did elevate democratic socialist politics into national political life and brought young people into socialist politics, into left groups, and particularly now the DSA. She recently saw those new people in Chicago, new young people, run candidates for the Chicago City Council, winning 5 seats and maybe 6, and defeating incumbents supported and other candidates supported by the remnants of the Democratic Party machine. So, Joanna Misnick, tell us what happened in Chicago, especially about the insurgent forces and in the election of alder people.
Well, the DSA decided there were so many city issues in which we were active that we decided to take those movements and give them a Tribune of the People voice in the city council by running in the recent city council elections. There are 50 seats. We carefully took a look at our strengths and where we were in what neighborhood. And we decided to run in 6 places. We ended up running an official DSA member, open DSA member, for those seats. And we won almost all of them. The 6th one that we're counting down now, she's 12 votes ahead of the machine candidate that she challenged. So now we have the possibility in Chicago of a socialist caucus inside the city council, which would be, as I said, the voice of the movements that brought us there politically, because there's a lot of ferment in Chicago, all the way from rent control to police brutality to taxing the rich. All this came together in terms of the DSA deciding to become a focal point in the council for these movements.
And these movements, then, you're discussing a group of people who ran together and saw themselves as the voices of movements.
Yes. Well, some people have the image of the DSA as strictly an electoral machine. And I just want to make sure that you understand we use the elections to bring forward the issues and the fights that are going around, whirling around us in our local areas. We are not strictly an electoral operation. That's a misconception that people have, that we just want to get elected. We're working with the Democratic Party. The reason we were able to run 5 of our own candidates is that, like many cities, the Chicago municipal elections are nonpartisan. So at the end of the day, on television, a couple of people, reporters, were referring to us as the Democratic Socialist Party, totally independent from the other two. So we made our point that we're here as the Democratic Socialists and not an adjunct of the Democratic Party in this city, which is falling apart anyway.
Joanna Misnick, tell us again about the program, the sorts of basically reforms, the sorts of demands that were being made, but then we can talk about the sort of the underlying politics of it, the sort of the view of who should hold power, how should power be organized, who in fact deserves to have their voices heard, all of those sort of underlying questions. But tell us first just about their program, then we can talk about
how the program reflects the fact that the working class in this country, in this city, is fighting to preserve its neighborhoods and to preserve its standard of living against what is an absolute onslaught on the part of a neoliberal mayor and his pinstripe patronage program. And throughout the city, the mainstay, the first cannonball that came out was, of course, police brutality and the Laquan McDonald murder by the cops, shooting this kid fleeing from them 16 times in the back. And the young black folks in this town, the movement they built, the energy they showed in getting the perpetrator of that crime actually convicted, because very often police brutality perpetrators are not, but this fellow was convicted, and the whole expansion of that into a movement for civilian control of the police instead of, you know, a private board that's appointed by the mayor was electrifying in this city, and it began to change the course of politics, because Mayor Rahm Emanuel had hidden the findings that this murder of Laquan McDonald was just that, an unnecessary shooting, a murder, because he was running for office and he didn't want the scandal to taint his campaign. So it was deliberately covered up. And when it was brought into the public eye, it, of course, not only embarrassed, but shook the foundation of Rahm Emanuel's regime, and ultimately was one of the reasons he decided not to run again. So it's the police brutality movement of the young black folks in this town that started the thing. The other is the escalated gentrification in all of the wards, where rents are being raised so high so as to push people out so that the gentrifiers and the developers can come in, and the total complicity of City Hall and the ward councilmen, the members of council, with these developers, the paybacks they get, the amount of money that the developers give to the ward bosses in order to get the zoning requirements and get their cooperation to push especially black and brown working people out of a neighborhood so that they can gentrify it. It's pretty blatant, and we started a movement along with community folks for rent control. Like many states, the Koch brothers came through in the late 90s and passed a lot of legislation in various states, including our own, one of which was you can't have rent control. It's illegal. So we have to do a two-tiered battle to take that legislation out and to instead place legislation enabling cities and municipalities to enact rent control. That was another big fight. The other, of course, is an elected school board. After Emanuel closed 50 schools in black and brown neighborhoods, the fact that our school board is appointed by the mayor, we have one or two of the heads of the school board are already in prison for fraud. We have been fighting to get an elected school board in our town. Again, that required legislation in Springfield, but it's a very popular demand, and it has a movement behind it, as does generally the issue of education. We're the only city in the country where charter school teachers are unionized. And we just recently had two strikes, and we're about to have a third next week for getting contracts for charter school teachers who have signed up with the teachers union. We hope that we've been involved in that, and we hope it'll catch fire across the country. There's a million issues that were electrifying movements and trying to bring pressure on the what they call the rubber stamp city council, and people just got fed up.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Joanna Misnick, a labor organizer and once communications director of Local 73 of the SEIU and Chicago Public Workers. She's now retired, still very, very active in Chicago. We just talked about the struggles that were ignited by the killing of Laquan McDonald, but movements that then grew from that into raising all the other issues that are impacting working people in Chicago, including the closing down of schools in their areas, rent control, police brutality. Joanna, you described it as started by young and black people. To what extent has the movement grown and attracted white working class and young white and Latino people?
Well, Latino youth are active in general. The level of political mobilization in the Latino community, the Latinx communities here, is pretty high. If you notice, of the five, potentially six aldermen that we have elected, five of them are from Latinx communities. And the issue of immigration and sanctuary. And the other thing we have, which crosses the black and brown communities, is this thing called the gang database. The city claims to have a list of everybody who's in a gang. It's 134,000 names collected, nobody knows how. It absolutely punishes people who are on it who've never been in a gang. And it work. They work with the immigration ICE, because if your name is on the database as a gang member, then you're immune from our sanctuary city operation that we do have here. We have sanctuary city regulations about what ICE can and cannot do. However, if your name is on the database, you're exempt from those protections, and that affects a great number of Latinx youth who are fighting against the use of that gang database and to expand the rights of Sanctuary City.
Oh, I see. So, in fact, it's the police who run the database, and it's
right.
And it's police gang enforcement that decides who they want to have deported, I guess.
Right.
I mean, that's it seems like it's just a direct transmission belt to deportation run
right,
by
exactly.
the Chicago police. Yeah, I could imagine how that would. What about white working class people and white youth?
I can't give you a glowing report. I mean, there's a general leftward shift of all young people. Actually, the DSA here is young and predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
The people who join the DSA here we're having a program to reach out to black and Latin young people, because the surge in the DSA in almost every city was almost entirely white. And it's a problem that we have to solve through our activism and coalitions and partnerships that we're trying to do here.
But the DSA was then working in these with the neighborhoods where you had winning candidates, apparently.
Oh, yes. The army of DSAers in these neighborhoods was predominantly white. They were working side by side with the neighbors who lived there. And the irony is that as violently opposed to gentrification as DSA is, in many instances, young white folks move into these neighborhoods that had been traditionally black and Latin, and their population there is used by the gentrifiers to try to crack the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's how it is in all the cities. There are the early pioneers who are often really wonderful people, right? And,
right, become the gate crashers, so to speak.
Right.
Yes.
Well, that's another dilemma. It could be solved, it seems to me, through a national housing program.
Sure.
I mean, there are solutions to all of these issues instead of pitting parts mm-hmm. of the working class against themselves.
Right.
This is KBOO Radio again, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joanna Misnick. She's been organizing in Chicago for many years, recently heartened by the alderperson election in Chicago, where the radicals won 5 and maybe even 6 seats. We've been talking about that movement, which has been mostly people of color in their neighborhoods, Latin and black and brown. The DSA, though, that's supporting them is primarily white, but I'm sure there are some black and brown people.
Sure.
Tell us about the ways in which, I mean, the DSA is democratic and it's socialist. And the question is, the question always becomes in left organizations that get involved in politics and sometimes even run within the Democratic Party like Bernie Sanders did. And it was very important, in fact, that campaign had tremendously dynamic effects in raising questions and building an insurgent movement, an insurgent left movement that's way beyond the Democratic Party now. How in this electoral contest do you escape just complete electoralism? We just have to win this election. We'll say anything to people in order to make sure that some moderates and independents will vote for us. We're very careful not to offend any business interest or be seen as anti-business, which we're not anti-enterprise. How is that happening? What's your sense of how those tensions are being resolved in Chicago?
Well, it was easier this time around because it was a nonpartisan election. So you don't have to have any relationship to the Democratic Party to run. You get a few signatures and you get on there on your own steam. And this was a moment in Chicago politics once Rahm Emanuel stepped away. The machine in the wards had been crumbling. He didn't care. The mayor daily, the old mayor, would go to visit all the ward bosses and be very intimate with what was going on in the development of the party within the wards, the old-fashioned kind of thing. Emanuel never visited the wards, ever. He visited the Wall Street bankers who were in Chicago. He visited the financiers and the real estate developers. And he started a different form of patronage, which was to the 1%, to capital in the city, leaving the wards on their own. So by the time we come to run, some of these ward bosses are completely weakened. The structure of the Democratic Party machine in these wards has eroded enormously. To give you an example, I live in a ward where a DSAer won, Andre Vasquez, against a guy who'd been in the city council since 1983 and was the zoning czar of the council. Zoning is very important if you're working with the developers. And he was the czar, toppled him by 1,000 votes because that ward machine was gone. In other wards, the same thing happened. We came along with a program that sounded attractive, that had the working class point of view and was alive to the movements that people actually saw in their neighborhoods, and the machines in many of these wards simply melted down. And I think that's going to be happening, if it hasn't already, in other major U.S. cities. But it was particularly keen here because Emanuel sort of downed his tools and walked away in the middle of, just before the election.
One final issue. How do socialists build a consciousness of the deservingness of working people, that the bosses' brains are under the workers' hats, that we have immense talents and capacities throughout the population, often stifled, and in fact, a lot of people are demoralized and ruined. But what we need is to engage everybody and as much as possible in the political process and help people or contribute to creating a culture where people are recognized as and want to participate with their neighbors in building their society instead of being objects of other people's decisions. How does that happen within, is it happening, and in what way is that happening within the movements in Chicago?
As far as my chapter of the DSA is concerned, you just articulated its point of view. There's no question. This is an anti-capitalist chapter that seeks to, what we say, center the working class and talks about socialism ultimately as a system that will eliminate the profit makers, that will eliminate the 1%, and will be able to fulfill human need.
There's so many wonderful things to talk about, Joanna, but I think this interview has gone on to the extent of time that we are afforded, and there's going to be many more months and years for discussion and struggle. And the other side is running into some kinds of contradictions, like global heating, that it cannot handle. It is impossible for it to actually stop its reckless sort of growth and accumulation. We are really looking at kind of a civilizational or planetary crisis in the next 20, 30, 40 years, and we're sort of preparing for it, is at least my sense of things. Why don't you respond to that, and then we'll conclude.
Well, the DSA has something called the Green New Deal.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which is a set of principles of what we can do and what we must do to save the planet and to develop a rational, humane society. It's not just about fossil fuels and stuff. It's about reproduction, social reproduction. What is the standard we must meet for human need and how humans live? What is the decommodification of so many things in our lives, ultimately including the decommodification of the labor market? It's a long list of 10 principles that guide the strategy of the DSA, and the concern is eco-socialism, but it goes well beyond it. The number 10 is anti-imperialist. Stop all the wars, stop the Pentagon, stop the war machine, not just because the Pentagon pollutes, but because of the society we want to build. a sustainable world society. And we're starting to educate those principles. Were just adopted, and there are educationals going in and around all over the DSA on this question of linking socialist goals and a vision of socialist society to the immediate problems and beyond.
Gina Misnick, it was really great talking to you. Thank you. Keep up your good work.
Thank you.
Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. Later in our program, we'll have Jan Hawken talking with Anais Tipker, who is with 50PDX. They'll be talking about an Earth Day event coming up tonight at the First Unitarian Church. There'll be a film screening and some other great events around that. The film is Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, and is directed by our very own Jan Hawken. We'll conclude the program with an archival piece, The Importance of Historical Memory for Social Movements, that was Todd Sloan and Sandy Polishuk from October 12, 2015. But next up, we have Clayton Morgridge, who's discussing music, language, and capitalism.
I was thinking about how music and language are alike and yet different. And this is the train of thought that came to me. We might think of music as structuring time. Music exists in time, and it moves through time by changing pitch, volume, tempo, rhythm, and timbre. By combining different pitches, chords are created which modulate through time. A beat is established, a grid against which tempo and rhythm occur. Variations of pitch structured in time, creating melodies. And every pitch has a timbre, a sound quality, like the difference between a cello and a saxophone. And when two or more instruments are combined, as with a symphony orchestra, there are many variations of sound quality. All of this is produced and received by feeling and thinking creatures whose experience of life is temporal. We live and act and feel in time. We desire and fear what we see coming over the horizon of our lives. We are excited or relaxed, which are ways of feeling ourselves in time. The patterns of music intersect and interact with the patterns of our feelings, with the risings and fallings of our vitality, amplifying and encouraging or guiding us in new directions, opening up unsuspected possibilities for thinking and feeling about the world. Could this way of thinking about music have any bearing on how to think about language? Language that is spoken or sung comes at us in time and has a lot in common with music. But language has the added dimension of cognitive meaning. It tells us how things are or could be in the world, either in fiction or in reality. We respond emotionally to stories, but not as directly as we do to music. Music reaches out and into our emotional lives, grabbing us by the heartstrings. But words have to be understood in terms of what they say about how things are or will be in order for them to have emotional impact. There is an additional moment of processing between the words and their cognitive and emotional uptake. What can we say about the cognitive content of language? How does it say things about the world? One idea about this is that the things we say to each other represent the world, rather as maps or pictures do, and these help us to organize our lives together. This is the practical dimension of language. By way of language, we lay out a map of our world which we can use to give guidance to each other about what is to be done. But just knowing how things in the world are laid out is not enough. We also want to know why things are the way they are. We want understanding, explanation, and this gives rise to science. We could call this enterprise making sense of the world. And before there was modern science, there was the desire to make human sense of the world, to know the purpose of it all. We want to know not just what causes things to be as they are, but what the purpose of it all is. Religions have always had answers to this question. For example, our purpose is to live as our Heavenly Father intends us to, and thereby to be loved and not condemned by Him. Great music has come from this idea, the great masses by Bach, Fauré, and Brahms, for example, or hymns and gospel music. But religion is often divisive, and many people can no longer believe our lives have any overarching purpose established from above by a God. Yet lives lived without any sense that they mean something, that they are of value, are often lived in despair and end in suicide. How, then, do we give purpose to our lives, personally and collectively? We don't need the Buddha to tell us that to live is to suffer. We all know this from our own experience if we have lived long enough, though most people on our planet learn to suffer almost from the beginning. Our bodies can inflict pain and disability on us at any age, and will certainly do so in the end. Floods, fires, and earthquakes can undo our lives, not to mention accidents that can happen anywhere and any time, and not to mention war. The universality of suffering offers us a purpose to help each other. All who live need help from all the rest, as Bertolt Brecht wrote. Since we live so much inside each other's lives, we can do more than alleviate suffering. We can give each other pleasure and even joy. And music is one way to do that. We need to recognize, though, that most of the suffering I mentioned a moment ago is intensified and enormously multiplied by the capitalist social arrangements under which we live, and these arrangements produce massive suffering on their own. For everything we need to survive and flourish in life, we are dependent upon the ability of wealthy and powerful elites to maintain and extend their wealth and power by exploiting and expropriating our labor and the little that we have. Food is not produced and distributed to meet our needs, but to profit agribusiness corporations and their stockholders on Wall Street, leaving billions to starve. Healthcare is managed to maximize profits for insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and hospitals. We see people homeless on the streets because housing is a privately owned, profit-making commodity. Government services like Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, education, and assistance with food and housing are constricted by policies of austerity, engineered by the wealthy to lower their tax bills and create a needier and more exploitable workforce. The money and political power of oil companies enables them to block or cripple every serious effort to avert the impending climate catastrophe and the near universal suffering that will result from it. So to live is to suffer. But under capitalism, much of this suffering is needless, inflicted upon us by a political and economic system that works in the interests of the few. So not only can we give aid, comfort, and joy to the suffering people around us, but we can try to alleviate the additional misery that is inflicted by capitalism. And we can join in the work already underway to challenge and delegitimize the right to privately own the resources we all need to live and to live well. And music has its role to play here as well. There's a rich tradition of protest songs, labor songs, and peace songs. Yet almost all music, from string quartets and symphonies to rock and roll bands and hip-hop, engages us in places within us of which we cannot speak, but which deserve liberation from the chains of capital. Music shows us how much more there is to us than what can be sold for money, and why we cannot flourish in a social world where money is the measure of all things. Why couldn't life be as beautiful as the most beautiful music? I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks to Tammy Dean, our engineer, sitting in and helping us out. We're always happy to see her with us. She blows a kiss to the audience. Our listening audience, yeah. Next up, we have Jan Hawken talking with Anise Tipker, who is with 350 PDX. They're here to talk about an event coming up this evening, Earth Day, and it's an exciting event, so we're hoping to get some folks out to that. Jan, take it away.
Anise, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much for having me, Jan.
So this is the 50th year of Earth Day in April in the United States, something perhaps to both recognize and mourn in terms of the climate crisis becoming even more daunting by the day. Let's talk a little bit about where you see the in our first minute or two.
In our first minute or two, right.
The last 50 years, the high points and the low points. And then we'll talk about 350 PDX and the commitments of that organization locally and nationally, and how some of the themes of the climate justice movement are in the film we'll be seeing tonight.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I'm not 50 years old, so there's some early history that I was not part of, obviously, but and that I mentioned that partly to be silly, but partly because this is...
You've grown up in a world.
Exactly. I've grown up in a world where this has been, you know, the world has been changing in such profound ways throughout my entire lifetime. And yet for a lot of it, I was not aware of it as a young person growing up. And in the 80s, I think my perception was of Earth Day as a fairly mild sort of nice kind of holiday.
Like going to the park for a picnic.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a good thing to do, always. But I think that was partly just misperception on my part, because I think really as I've learned more and become more active in this work, there's always been a side of the celebration of Earth Day that is a little bit of greenwashing, of sort of making it seem like it's very easy to solve these problems through individual actions.
And companies across the board now have icons that nod to that.
Right.
Healthy, clean energy.
Exactly.
Clean versus dirty. No one wants to be dirty. Even our president is really big on clean.
That's right. All that clean coal.
Yeah.
Which doesn't exist in any form. But there's always been this much more action-directed side to it. The first kind of precursor, Earth Day, was in response to an oil spill off the coast of California. And so we are still sadly dealing with oil spills, dealing with the constant degradation of the environment, dealing with the warming of the planet from the fossil fuel industry's actions. And I think now we're seeing more and more of that collective action really become the focus of Earth Day. I mean, right now, at this moment here in Portland, yesterday there was an action taken led by Extinction Rebellion, which is a group that people probably have seen a lot in the news the last week. They're a relatively new group.
Very active in the UK.
They started in the UK, and they basically took London and held the city for, I think, 4 or 5 days, really demanding, and their main demand is just tell the truth. Just tell the truth of how serious this crisis is.
And the strategy of civil disobedience or civil resistance, some people prefer that term, is to interrupt business as usual.
To interrupt business as usual. And so in their case, part of it is also that disobedience is willing arrest, saying, you know, we are willing to get arrested. You can't dissuade us from taking a stand on this just because of that. So just to bring it back locally, Extinction Rebellion took the lead on organizing an event here on the tracks that lead to the Zenith export facility, which is in Northwest Portland. They have been quietly expanding the shipping of tar sands oil out of the Port of Portland. This is one of the dirtiest, most destructive fossil fuels on the planet. And they've been expanding the amount of oil shipped out of Portland. We don't want any of that. It goes against the spirit of a ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure that the city is implementing. But because of old permits, they're still legally allowed to do it. So people are saying we need to stop this. So they led planting a garden on the tracks and declared that space a green space for the people of Portland, and they're going to ask City Council to back up what they have already declared.
So that's a story to continue.
That's
to
a
follow.
Story happening right now. Yeah.
And these in the film that will be at the event tonight, mm-hmm. a benefit for the film, Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, mm-hmm. That I also been involved in as part of that team. and it's a benefit for the film and for 350 PDX. And that film features a local struggle against the tar sands oil pipelines in Minnesota, yes. and how that their local struggle is connected with a larger network, not only network of pipelines, but the film features the network of activism. And this is a terminal for oil, but also a terminal for resistance
yeah.
here that
yeah.
connects with the struggle people will see in the film.
I do think that's a really important point to bring up, how it is so important that people take local action and find where they can effectively intervene and put pressure on the fossil fuel industry. And at the same time, those local actions have to be strategic and kind of integrated into that larger network. And so, you know, part of why Zenith has been expanding is because the pipelines have not, numerous pipelines have not been successful in going forward, right? So we become the outlet. And if we don't stop this, then we're kind of not playing our part, right?
In this network of resistance.
In this network of resistance,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's like a fire with everybody along the line with the bucket, passing the buckets of water. Yeah,
right.
Well, you commented earlier about the importance of civil disobedience, mm-hmm. civil resistance, and willingly being arrested. But one of the themes taken up, and when we were invited to follow the stories of Honor the Earth water mm-hmm. protectors in Minnesota.
Yes.
And much of their story centered on their experiences in the courts and the criminal justice. It's very different from the experience of more privileged, typically non-Indigenous or white people.
Yes.
And how you form alliances that recognize that difference. And that is a theme in the film, is what does it mean to be an ally and to acknowledge Indigenous leadership and experience? And they're often described as the sacrifice zones in the climate crisis, having the worst and most immediate effects
mm-hmm.
Thrust on often reservations around the country or other lands that are the source of oil and other extractive industries that affect Native communities so severely. How does 350 around the country address this larger issue of being allies in struggles where, since Standing Rock, Indigenous communities have taken the lead? How do you think about that?
Well,
issue.
So 350.org is the national organization. They're a separate organization. 350 PDX is actually it's a separate organization. So I don't.
And there are 350s
all over the country.
All over the country.
We work together strategically, but uh-huh. we each sort of, you know, do the and we're all concerned with this issue, and I think and very much concerned with the question of what does it mean to be a good ally or a good accomplice, as people sometimes prefer.
The subversive term, to embrace it.
Yeah, especially I think if we're talking about civil disobedience and the point you raised that that's a very different experience if you come from a position of privilege and if you are not a Black or Brown or Indigenous person, your experience with that system will be very different and probably much less dangerous. And so, you know, the whole thing behind sort of the language of being an accomplice is that willingness to really not just stand by someone, but to actively be with them in breaking the law and holding some of that danger, because the system that we live in means that you do have some privilege and safety. And so I think for a lot of people in the movement, including me personally, you know, part of what I think about is I cannot escape that. So how do I use it? What do I do with it? That is the best that I can do. So it is it's a big question, and I think also the question of leadership. I mean, Standing Rock really brought that to the attention of the whole country, but I think leadership from Indigenous communities has always been the case. We've just sometimes been bad at recognizing it. So that's not a new thing. I think we just need to get better at listening and integrating and paying attention and following that leadership.
And as Tara Hauska, an attorney and organizer with Honor the Earth in Minnesota, is featured in the film, as she speaks in one scene to the audience, she describes the beauty and purpose in struggle, that there's sorrow and it's very difficult and there's hardship, but there's also tremendous beauty in struggle. And
yes.
I like to think of the role of film and music and other aspects of the cultural side of resistance as providing some of the sense of beauty and without over romanticizing struggle either.
But it's tremendously important.
Yeah, and that it's an interesting life to be be a radical, and we were living in that, and thus in very interesting times.
It is part of, I mean, what I personally often say is like this work, it's so, it's difficult times, it's enormous problems, but this is my chance to be a real human being. What does that mean? And that's beautiful.
Yeah. So we can learn more tonight. And you want to say a little bit about the when and the where and the what of tonight, the event?
Sure. So tonight we are screening the film Necessity. It's starting, doors open at 6:30 at First Unitarian Church?
First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main in downtown Portland.
We're going to have a brief panel beforehand with the filmmakers and some local activists who've been taking different forms of direct action and doing a lot of other things. And then we'll see the film, and then we'll have a reception with music and raffle prizes
and food and drink
and good company and beauty, because that is important.
And Django Fields is a local band that will be performing. So
yes, bringing some of that good music.
Yeah, so it'll be a satisfying cultural experience, as well as hopefully events that will inspire people to get involved and to learn more about 350 PDX and to support the support your work.
Yes, please come out.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Anais.
Thank you, Jan.
Tipker, with the lead organizational
lead for organizational resilience.
That sounds like
it's a funny name.
A worthy role.
It basically means we're in it for a long time.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you both, Jan and Anais. We're going to shift now to our last segment of the day. This is from the archive from our friend and comrade Todd Sloan. And Todd, who was a professor emeritus of counseling and psychology in the grad school at Lewis and Clark College, he died this past December 17th, 2018. We do miss him and feel fortunate to have an archive of his work on KBOO. Many, many contributions. I do encourage listeners to look him up on the website and see what's out there. He really did speak to his commitment to developing systems to support activists and change agents in grassroots ecological and social justice organizations. And the segment we present to you now is right in that vein, the importance of historical memory for social movements. He interviewed in October 12th, 2015, Sandy Polishek, who's also with 350 PDX, an oral historian and longtime activist. And we'll turn to that recording now.
Welcome, Sandy. Today we're going to be talking about activism in general, and especially in your role as an oral historian, looking at various past activism and documenting that for future generations. We'll be talking some about the importance of memory and reflection on where we've been as well as where we're going. So could you tell us first just sort of what has been your trajectory as an activist over the years, the kinds of things you've been involved in, your motivations for that?
Well, I got involved, probably the first thing really deeply was with during the Vietnam War, but it seems like everybody who was of age then was involved in the Vietnam War, and it was a very exciting time.
What kind of roles did you play back then?
I was in an organization called the Society for New Action Politics, SNAP, but I ended up mainly working with draft counseling for men who didn't want to be drafted, didn't want to go, an alternative to going to Canada or going to jail, although a lot of people did choose those as well. But before the war was even over, I got pulled into the women's movement and was very, very involved there, doing a lot of consciousness-raising groups, speaking. It was a very exciting time.
And where were you then?
I was here.
In Portland.
I was here. I came to Portland in 1966. And, well, I got involved with KBOO, which I definitely consider activism. But I also got involved with Jewish groups working for peace and justice, first in the early 80s with New Jewish Agenda, and then quite recently, in the last 10 years or so, with Brit Zedek V'Shalom, which then turned into J Street, which is still active. But I've moved on to climate work and very devoted to that. I think it's the issue of our time.
So at some point you started doing oral histories in relation to movement.
Yes, yes. In about 1980, I got involved with a group called the Northwest Women's History Project. I really got involved with them because I was at KBOO and I wanted to get more interviewing skills. And they were starting to do interviews with women who had worked in the shipyards during World War II, doing, quote, men's work, unquote. And I got totally hooked. And of the women in that, I and one other person who was getting her PhD in history are the two that continued to do oral history afterwards. So we produced what's now a DVD called Good Work Sister. It chronicles the women that worked in the five shipyards during the war, World War II, in this area. Then I went on to interview mostly radical older women. And out of that, one of those interviews with Julia Rutila turned into a book, Sticking to the Union, which is an oral history-based biography. But I've done other oral histories. I've done a couple with women who were in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, and I did one with a woman who was a breast cancer activist, and I've taught oral history. So it's really made me appreciate what we have to learn from the past.
I know it's hard probably to generalize about what you learn from looking back and hearing stories about what happened in past activism and struggle. But is there something especially that you personally have gained from that that inspires your activism from hearing the stories of others and dimensions that come out as you do that?
One of the things that oral historians say is that every time someone dies, it's like a library burning down. So there's this great desire to preserve for the future. I've seen oral history books that are based on other people's oral histories, people who've gathered the interview and done nothing more than archive it, and someone else comes along and it's useful to them, either documenting that person or documenting a subject. So there's that just desire to archive. In one sense, everyone needs to reinvent the wheel for themselves. In another sense, we would never make any progress if that's where, if we start, all start from zero. So we start, whether it's in science or in politics or in the arts, we start on the backs of those who came before us. So the more we can learn how power works, how winning works, one thing you can learn from history is that most victories are not permanent. You win something, and then you have to fight to keep it.
Yeah.
And we see that with the right to abortion. That's, you know, one of the things that comes to mind first now, just because that fight is so...
ongoing.
It's ongoing. It's ongoing. And you celebrate having won, and then you have to be prepared and know that this is coming. Mm-hmm. So you're not surprised by it, that you can prepare for what's going to come. And it's one way of learning. Mm-hmm. It's not the only way.
I suppose there are lessons both at the individual level for how to keep going as an individual, but also lessons for groups and mistakes they make. You were talking about sort of that the sort of one step ahead and two steps back kind of process of history, right?
Right.
But
right.
How about activist groups themselves? What do you bring into your own work with groups now that you might have learned?
Well, I'd like to say something about individuals, because mm-hmm. I think one of the big dangers is burnout, and that inspiration is the wrong word, but I keep in mind that even Emma Goldman took several years off. The same thing with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She was active in the Wobblies, and then she was active in the Communist Party, but she took several years off, actually here in Portland, mm-hmm. and then she went back to New York and got into the main throes of the movement. But there's a gentleness that I want to promote to activists, so that they take care of themselves and recognize that their emotional health, their social life, their time off is very important to sustaining their activism, mm-hmm. as well as having a decent life.
Because in my experience, sometimes those people who are not taking care of themselves end up affecting the progress of the group that they're in by being, I don't know, unreasonable or whatever.
It can disrupt things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So definitely that's important for the group. And of course, we need to learn and about group process and all of those things. When I came into the movement during the Vietnam War, I was young and there were older people there. And I don't think we gave them respect and we listened to them to a point, but I don't think we gave them enough respect for their experience. So I'm not saying that young people need to kowtow to their elders, mm-hmm. but I am saying that they need to recognize that they don't know everything, that people who've been around for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years in the movement might have something to tell them and to tell the organization. One of the things I like best about working in the climate movement is the age diversity. Mm-hmm. I work with people in their 20s. I work with people every age up from there, and it's wonderful.
So, and you're saying how reflection on the past does inspire your current work in the climate change work. Is there anything in particular you draw on the past that you're sort of channeling or as you move forward?
Wow, that's a hard question. So much of what we do is so new now. All the computers and the social media and the ways of communicating. I came from an era where we had to use snail mail, telephone trees, and that simplified the work in many ways, but it's made it less personal. So there's always gains and losses with new things. I don't know that I can answer that specifically.
Well, one thing people still emphasize, I think, is that the importance of the personal relationship building, trust building in order for groups to be effective. So I think that's something to carry forward.
Yeah. I find myself saying to people, I emailed them and I haven't heard back. And so my first response is, have you tried calling? I think there, you know, those are some things we kind of forget that mm-hmm. maybe not everybody looks at their email every day. And there's just definitely old-fashioned ways, getting out on the street, door knocking, tabling, those kinds of things are still useful.
And maybe they're even more powerful now that we have so little face-to-face contact. But, well, we need to wrap this up now. Thanks for answering the email that invited you to this interview. And I've been talking with Sandy Polishook, who's an oral historian and activist with 350 PDX. And this is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
and you have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. For more information on the fundraising event this evening, the Necessity Film Screening 350 PDX, go to Facebook, Necessity Screening. You'll find all the details there, including tickets. We have Locus Focus coming up next, Clean Energy Jobs Bill for Earth Day. Between the Covers follows that, and Voices for the Animals. We'll see you next week.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 22nd, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Jesus Christ Superstar. Jesus Christ Superstar is a 1970 rock opera with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. The story is loosely based on the Gospel's account of the last week of Jesus' life. Again, that's Jesus Christ Superstar showing Monday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10:01, and coming up next is Locus Focus.